Life, culture, and current events from a biblical perspective. 2020 on Vision.
As a parent, we're going to be talking today about how you react if you discover that your child or your teenager is self-harming. You might be angry, you might be sad, you might be frustrated or disappointed or even numb if you discover that your teenager is holding their breath until they pass out, or smashing their fingertips with a hammer, or scratching wounds so they won't heal, or burning their skin with lighters, or swallowing poisonous substances. Well, our special guest today has seen these behaviours. There's lots of ways that our children can harm themselves. So a focus today on ways that we might address self-harm and promote the idea of self-care. When emotions are escalating, how do we help our children and our teenagers move in a positive direction rather than wanting to harm themselves? Well, our special guest this hour is Michelle Mitchell, whose latest book, only just released, is called Self-Harm, Why Teens Do It, and What Parents Can Do to Help. Michelle is an author. She's an award-winning speaker. She founded an organization called Youth Excel, a charity that supports thousands of young people and their families with mentoring and psychological services. And just a pleasure to welcome Michelle along to 2020. Michelle, a special welcome.
Neil, it's such a pleasure to be here, and hello to everyone who's listening today as well.
From what I understand, your book is only just out, and this is the first public interview you're doing on this book then, Michelle.
That's right. It all starts tomorrow. So we're in first, Neil. This is great.
It is great. I'm absolutely privileged. Listen, Michelle, let's start. This is really such a difficult topic for us to even listen to. But if you're a parent right in the middle of this, and or if you're someone who's been through these issues, these things are going to be very, very important to listen in on. But let's talk self-harm, and maybe we need to just really ask that question, what is self-harm, as we get the conversation underway? How do you describe it to people?
Yeah, that's right. People often see self-harm as cutting, but self-harm is any destructive behaviour that's deliberate. And self-harm is started in young people's destructive thinking and leads to behaviour. And it's the way they express or control emotional pain. So it's kind of like that stress plus something equals release circuit in their brain that is getting wired to actually be self-destructive.
Okay. In my introduction, I mentioned some of the things that you have seen in your own travels and in your own journey here. This idea of teenagers holding their breath till they pass out or smashing their fingertips with a hammer. Sorts of things that, I mean, the imagery that comes to mind even when you start to describe those things. These are the sorts of things you've come across. There'd be plenty of all sorts of ways that that teenagers have been harming themselves.
Even things like reckless driving and unsafe sex, I guess it's the intention that defines self-harm rather than the behaviour itself. So sometimes young people can be binge drinking to have fun or, you know, to fit in or to look cool or, you know, for a variety of reasons. But sometimes they can be binge drinking to deliberately hurt themselves. So I think we need to look at intention with our kids. And a minute ago, I alluded to the thought that destructive thinking leads to destructive behaviour. I think just staying connected to what our kids are thinking about themselves and how they're managing stress is incredibly important.
Interesting when you start to talk about binge drinking or reckless driving, because some of these things we might even think of as just rebellious behaviours, and this rebellion that we might see in our teenager, that as parents we might all expect to see in their development, but you're actually aligning those with the idea of self-harm too. So whether it's cutting or picking at sores or those sorts of things, there is a certain sense in which that's all connected into this whole rebellious idea?
Yeah, well, young people are experiencing big, overwhelming emotions. And for some of them, it's the very first time they felt overwhelmingly anxious or low or angry. And sometimes they're not quite sure whether they're going to get through these feelings. They're not sure how to manage these feelings. And when self-harm looks like a legitimate option, a choice can be to self-harm, but sometimes they can be self-harming without really connecting the dots. I've seen young boys get really angry and bash their hands against walls. And when they do, later on in retrospect, they're thinking to themselves, okay, I did that deliberately because I wanted to manage my emotions. But in the moment and in the time, they actually weren't thinking that that was their intention.
Okay, so hitting your fist against the wall, cutting yourself, these sorts of things, the release of the emotions, the emotional pressure that seems to be building up, and somehow or other the teenager or child, or could be an adult as well, no doubt, but we're seeing that as a way to release something that hopefully is stronger than the emotions that we're feeling, and it's pain.
Yeah.
Pain
yeah.
is involved.
Well, this is how the body copes with pain, okay? So it releases endorphins, and it has a chemical change in our body. And so just think of it like the pain of a really good workout or a mountain climb. How we feel after that is a little bit euphoric. It's a shift in our body's chemistry. And when a kid cuts themselves or does something deliberately to hurt themselves, not only does it shift the chemical state in their body, but their focus then goes on the wound itself, and the emotions that they were feeling tend to melt in the background. And that's the shift that happens when young people self-harm, and that's why it works for them. The other side of that is too, they then go into this recovery phase. So when your body's hurt itself, first of all, you're filled with adrenaline, and your body's coping with that pain and it's shifting the chemistry. But after that, it'll throw you into a recovery stage. And that recovery stage can be quite addictive for young people. It's almost like running headlong into a wall and getting immediately stopped. So think of it when young people's emotions are racing, and they're racing, 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 and self-harm's almost like this immediate stop to this pressure that they didn't know how to deal with.
Okay, let's talk through some of the warning signs that a parent might look for if this sort of self-harm might be happening in the life of their child or their teenager. What are the most significant warning signs, Michelle, that parents ought to be on the lookout for?
Yeah, a lot of these are going to sound like normal teenage behaviour, and that's the real challenge. But knowledge of others who are self-harming is one. 30% of young people self-harm because they have heard of it from their friends or seen their friends do it. So this becomes this kind of like knock-on effect. So we have to be really conscious of that. If we know that our kids' friends are self-harming, the impact that could have on them with the way they're managing things. Unexplained marks on their body is a really obvious one. Wearing long sleeves that aren't removed. Wearing baggy clothes. One of the ones that I find really interesting is I always found when I went to touch a young person or shake their hand, they'll be very cautious about me touching them if they were self-harming. And you can imagine if you've got a wound underneath your clothes, you almost jump before someone touches you when you've got a wound. And it's exactly the same with young people. They're very conscious of that wound, and therefore they're very reactive to touch. Wearing wristbands to cover up scratches on their arms or big fat watches. Secretive behaviour as well, spending a long time in their room, or items that could be used for cutting or burning going missing in strange places. That's just that physical isolation, and that social isolation always concerns me with young people. So self-harm is often linked to mental health struggles. So if a young person is feeling anxious or depressed or going through this period of time where they're feeling unstable, they're more susceptible to self-harm as well.
Okay, a lot of these things ordinary teenagers might do. And
yeah.
When we talk about how many young people are self-harming, is there any sort of research that's been done that can identify how the numbers look? I mean, if you've got a yeah. teenager who's self-harming, is this something that, you know, you're on your own here and nobody else ever suffers this, or is this something
yeah.
that's fairly common to a lot of families?
You know, when families find out about it, they're often quite, ashamed and shocked because it's not something we talk about a lot. Research around this is quite difficult because, the data is normally collected when young people go to hospitals or visit GPs. And research also tells us that 85% of young people who self-harm don't go to a hospital and don't go to a GP. And it's a relatively minor occurrence that happens in isolation in their room at home. Drugs and alcohol aren't involved and they don't need medical attention. So at that point, or medical attention for the wound, so at that point when the data is collected, it's about 10% of young people that are presenting and are suggesting that are self-harming. However, there's other community studies that are showing that up to 27% in some regions. So we have to be really conscious that this is much more common than we think it is. And it's often a strategy that young people pick up for a short period of time and then perhaps can let go again quite quickly as well. But during these teenage years, especially the middle school years, they're much more susceptible to trying strategies like this.
Michelle, is there anything that we could pick up on here? City kids, country kids, does this happen more if you're in a city environment? I mean, you know, the social groups that people are in differ according to the sort of town that they might live in.
Yeah,
is there any sort of research that says, you know, this is actually tough for kids who are isolated, or kids who are, you know, you can be even lonely and isolated even if you're in the middle of a big group. But what sort of thoughts are there on the country versus the city?
Yeah, I don't know any stats on that. What I do know is there is a strong link to mental health issues. So if you're in a region where there's a lot of anxiety and depression, my guess is that there would be higher rates of self-harm. So that would be the only link that I would draw there.
Okay, and I know that one of the solutions you look for is, of course, building and nurturing strong and intimate family relationships here. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter where you live, whether it's the city or the country, sometimes mm-hmm. the factor that is affecting the mental health of your teenager and the potential for them to even move into these areas of self-harm might be because they've not got that sort of intimacy within a family group, which is very protective. What are your thoughts about families and the value that they have when you've got young people who are prone to self-harm?
Family is just massive, and I've seen kids literally praise their parents for the hilt once they've gotten through a tough patch for sticking by them and standing with them, because the support of and the love of a family, that just unconditional backbone in your life is, you know, goes a long way. I will say this as well, though, that I've seen young people self-harm who have amazing families. And so you can't always draw a link between the closeness of a family and whether a child self-harms or not. And I think that's really important for parents to hear, because parents are the first people to blame themselves. You know, maybe we aren't close enough, maybe we're not communicating enough. You know, maybe if I did X, Y, and Z, things will be different. But for some young people, this is like an experimentation of, will the strategy work for me? And it's part of their journey. And you can't blame yourself for that. In saying that, parents that stand with their kids and for their kids is just, you know, irreplaceable in their lives. And I always say that parents are their kids' greatest advantage. You know, what you add and what you do in that moment actually really does matter.
Okay, parents and families are really, really important here, but it's not necessarily an entire way that you would escape this problem, because even the best families can find their teenagers suffering in these ways.
Helping you make sense of life, culture and current events from a biblical perspective. 2020 on Vision.
Our talkback line open on 1-800-316-316. Our special guest is Michelle Mitchell. Her book is called Self-Harm, Why Teens Do It and What Parents Can Do to Help. An opportunity today to interact with Michelle. Talkback line open, 1-800-316-316. In fact, before we move on, why don't we take a call from Vanessa, who's calling from Queensland. Hello, Vanessa. Welcome along.
Good morning.
Vanessa, what are your thoughts for our conversation today?
I've got a granddaughter. She's does self-harm. She burns herself. Oh. She gets a can and a spray can and burns her skin, and then she draws explicit pictures of hanging herself. And it's just like, oh, I'm in prayer. And constantly, and we argue, and she's only 11, and she smashes things, and I says, what's your problem? And she keeps putting herself down, and I says, you know, none of those things, you know, like, I'll try to build her confidence in herself, and she just have this self-hate inside of her.
Vanessa,
I don't know.
My heart goes out to you, and I know listeners will be even prayerful, even as they are hearing of the challenge that you have as a grandmother and talking through these things about your granddaughter. Let's get some thoughts here from Michelle. Michelle, what are your feelings and thoughts for Vanessa?
Well, Vanessa, first of all, my heart bleeds for you as well as a grandma looking at your little girl, and she's only 11, so that's a real challenge. I know that you've been listening as well. So I think one thing I'd like to say to you is, well, two things I want to focus in on is this young one is experiencing very strong, overwhelming thoughts and feelings. And during that time, she needs to feel as safe as possible. And we've got to try and find this little one some strategies to use instead of burning, instead of hurting herself, and instead of speaking destructively to herself as well. And the more safety and security you can bring around her, the better at the moment. I've known some mums that have just sat and massaged their daughter's feet. I've known other, you know, grandmas have taken their kids for walks just when their emotions start to get heightened. But when they're 11, it's actually really difficult sometimes for them to know when they're starting to escalate within themselves, and it can happen so, so quickly. I would be definitely getting some professional advice and support for her because of her age as well, and because of the intensity of it for her. And then as a family, try and look at some strategies that you can talk her through, some things that she can do instead of hurting herself and that possibly you can do with her. When we talk about self-care to kids, we're talking about things that they can both do alone but or and do with somebody else, because someone's not always there in the intensity of the moment.
Vanessa, is that helpful for you, Vanessa?
Yeah, yesterday she was in a rage and she started breaking things.
Yeah, and we want to try and catch it before it gets to that point. So once she's in a rage, or once she's burning, or once she's at that point where she's just, like, you know, full on into it, that's actually really hard for her to pick up self-care in that moment. But there's this whole sequential lineup to that moment where she's breaking things. And if you can try and catch it really, really early and help her walk down the ladder, I talk to kids about walking down the ladder or walking up the ladder of their emotions, help her walk down the ladder instead of keep walking up the ladder. She's doing things right now that are deliberately escalating her emotions to a really unhealthy place. And we have to teach her ways to rewind that, and bring her emotion down into a safe, secure, stable and settled place. And it's going to take some choices from her and possibly a little bit of maturity for her to be able to make those choices.
Vanessa from Queensland, I know that many listeners will keep you in their prayers, and thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story, and thanks so much for a great response from Michelle. Our talkback line remains open. You might have your own story to share. You might have your own insight into how you deal with these issues. 1-800-316-316. Thank you so much to Vanessa from Queensland for your call. This idea of reacting when you're in this circumstance, Michelle, because as we've been hearing there from Vanessa, parents are going to react in different ways. Most of the time, we're not going to know what to do. Getting these insights so valuable. But parents' reactions to self-harm, because what are your thoughts about a right way and a wrong way to react?
Oh, it's so difficult, isn't it? Like, everything inside us wants to protect our children. It goes against every innate instinct that we've got, you know. So it's distressing for parents, and it evokes, I guess, the strongest of emotions. And emotion on top of emotion is going to turn, you know, an issue into an absolute disaster. And so our biggest challenge for this is having some really clear, calm strategies to use rather than come in with more emotion and scream or yell or try and stop them. And, you know, like, it can end up being in, like, an absolute mess. So what we actually want to do is just be really clear about what we're doing, process our emotions away from our kids as much as we can, and come in as
early and as quickly as we possibly can on the cycle and just be help nudging them towards self-care rather than self-harm.
When you talk about a cycle, sometimes we're familiar with sort of a cycle of violence that happens in domestic violence situations. Is there a sort of a cycle that's going on in the lives of teenagers too, where their anger is building up or the emotions are, as you say, escalating? And that's mm-hmm. that's a cyclical thing. And as a parent, you can start to identify the beginning of that cycle and therefore start to take action at that point.
Mm-hmm. When you're talking about 11-year-old, and I know all, not all our listeners have 11-year-old children who are self-harming, but when you're talking about kids that young, they're often not aware of their own personal cycle, whereas you talk about 14 and 15-year-olds and they can feel self-harm building up a few days earlier. Most young people deliberately choose or say, I'm going to self-harm an hour before they do so. So they've got this wave of emotion, or they're riding this wave of intense emotion for that hour, and then they give into that temptation of it. And so what we want to do is try and help them with strategies during the most intense peaks of their emotions, know what to do instead of just resorting back to self-harm. And they will know in themselves this cycle that happens, and that's often what a professional can do to really help them as well. A psychologist or a counsellor, a chaplain at school, but just becoming really aware of where they're at self-harm and what the cycle is and what the intensity looks like for them.
Okay, I can hear something coming through that listeners will no doubt want to be taking note of if they're going through this, and this is the idea that there may actually be the need for some professional counselling here. Sometimes just understanding these things as a parent, you might actually be wise to seek some professional counselling too, because it gets quite deep and gets quite sophisticated in the way that you approach this. How often do you find, Michelle, that you're directing people to say, you need to get some professional help?
Absolutely. We are so close to our kids, and I think it's pretty well impossible for any parent to stay, level-headed in a situation like this. Professionals can be incredible support to parents, regardless of whether kids want to go and see a professional or not. But I would always 100% offer a young person the opportunity to see a counsellor or a psychologist when you find out that they're self-harming, because they often need someone independent to process their emotions with as well. We can't do that with them as parents. We're too close to the situation.
I imagine too there's a little level of humility required here for parents, because mm-hmm. they actually may be the trigger for some of this anger. And I imagine then that taking the third party, the professional counsellor, who can hear things and process things with the teenager that the parents can't. But sometimes we have to humble ourselves as parents and say, maybe we're a part of the problem, or the perception is that we're part of the problem.
Yeah, and to be honest, we are always part of the problem because we're so close to them. it's just the reality is we can never say it's just our kids' issue. It's always a family issue. Now, I think we often look for something to blame, and we do this because if we can identify that thing or that person or that experience and just pin it on that, it makes us kind of feel like we're in control of it. But the reality is we can't blame one thing. We can't blame a divorce. We can't blame our relationship with them. We can't blame sexual abuse as a single contributing factor. Research tells us that people go through a lot of difficulties in life, and some people do self-harm and other people don't. And so it's not the issue that automatically leads to self-harm. It's actually a whole combination of factors. And it's that combination of factors, those combination of circumstances, that can lead kids to make these kind of choices. I think it's really important for parents to know, because they often get very ashamed that their child has done this, or what did I do wrong? And then they blame themselves and feel ashamed about their parenting. But they're really doesn't need to be shame. There needs to be solutions, and there needs to be a way forward in this circuit and this pattern that's been established.
We're just a couple of minutes out from news, but let's take another call. Denise is on the line from Bunbury in Western Australia. Hello, Denise. Welcome along.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. Denise, what are your thoughts?
Sorry, I haven't been hearing all the conversation, but I have a son who is suicidal, and I just want to stress how important it is to get professional help. Also, prayer is so important, and binding, well, my son, he has a spirit of death and a spirit of suicide, so binding those every single day, as soon as I get up in the morning, that's it. I'm into warfare.
This is important.
Also, sorry?
Yep, keep going.
Also, standing in the gap for him and putting on the full armour of God, I pray Psalm 91 over my whole family. I plead the blood of Jesus Christ over him. God's given me scripture to pray over him. I think it's Psalm 40, it's the one about the miry clay.
Taking us out of the miry clay and set our feet on the solid rock. Yep.
I pray that for him every day as well. And there's other things. Binding, also loosing as well.
Denise,
helps.
Going to be powerful to bring the presence of God into the crises that are within our families. I wonder if you've got a thought, Michelle, for Denise.
Absolutely do. There's such power in a praying mum. There's nothing more fervent than a mum's prayer. And to bring prayer, faith, hope, and anchor ourselves on what God wants for our children is so important during any difficult time. And especially a time like this, it actually demands us to be very serious and aggressive with our faith. So you are just doing an incredible job with your son. I really want to emphasize as well, just like you did, that professional support is so important, because as parents, we can only step back and actually let our children make the choices they're going to make in life. And sometimes someone else is a better one to direct
Michelle,
and help.
I need
guide
to cut
that.
In here because we're about to go to news. We're back to
Not
continue after Vision National News. Just to mention, as we continue and get things underway, we'll take some more calls in just a short while, 1-800-316-316. But Michelle, you mentioned getting some professional help. Let me just mention that there is the Christian Counsellors Association of Australia that I occasionally will put their websites out for people who are looking for Christian counsellors, ccaa.net.au. If you're in a point of desperation, there's Lifeline, 13 11 14, and if you'd like to have prayer for an issue that's going on in your family, perhaps Vision's Christian prayer ministry called Pray For Me on 1-800-772-936. Michelle, we're going to take some calls again in just a few moments, but let's touch something here before we do take another call, because this issue of suicide has come up in our conversation. Now, not all self-harm is suicidal in tendency, but how do you actually talk about what's happening in self-harm in teenagers and the fears that every parent might have that their child is suicidal?
Yeah, when parents find out that their son or daughter is self-harming, they often ask me, look, why would my child want to die? And they instantly link it to suicide. It's really important for us to know that self-harm can be performed without the intention to wanting to die, so there can be no attempt of suicide. However, you know, there is a link there, and it's complex. Intentions can change, and I don't think we can make those assessments ourselves without taking them to a professional. So I would just honestly say that, you know, a doctor and then a clinical psychologist are probably the people to help you make those assessments yourself.
So this is where you don't wait around to look for more signs. Perhaps how quick do you think you make a decision to seek that professional help if you are fearful that your child is contemplating suicide?
Oh, straight away. If you're ever concerned about their safety, you call an ambulance. You know, it's not something that you muck around with at all. So I think sometimes we do tend to let things drag on and go a little bit too long because we're familiar with our kids, but it's just not worth the risk. So just straight to professionals. And if you can't get a young person there, one thing I will say is that you can go yourself, and those insights that you can get can really help you through the process of parenting a child who's self-harming.
Powerful advice there. We're taking calls on 1-800-316-316. You can also leave a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/visionradio. Let's take a call from Shelley in Western Australia. Shelley, thanks for waiting so patiently. What are your thoughts?
It's a
Shammy,
is that
right? Shammy. Okay, sorry, Shammy. I've got a little note. My note didn't have your name spelt right.
That's okay. Yeah, I'm just ringing to bring up a few points. My daughter, my youngest daughter, went through this. She's grown up now, so we've been come through it. But I just wanted to make a few little points that might be helpful for some parents out there who might be experiencing these things. My daughter was self-harming and suicidal, and she was taking herself to the school chaplain and psychologist, and they both rang me and said she was suicidal, and I had, you know, I could see something was wrong, and but she wouldn't talk about it, and I decided I'd have to be a little bit of a sleuth. So this is something parents might have to do. They might have to actually just kind of like really do a bit of sleuthing around, but things that might not sound so good, but like looking in a journal and thinking about some things. And I discovered anyway that her father had abused her, sexually abused her. We were divorced by then, but when she was a child, and she was not only self-harming and suicidal, she was also being bullied. She was being bullied at school. So sometimes there's bullying involved, sometimes there's sexual abuse involved that have caused this kind of behaviour, and she would not have help apart from what she was doing and going to the school psych and the chaplain.
Shammy, it must have been some... at least, feeling for you that she was actually going to the chaplain and looking for her own help. That must have been, you know, of some comfort to you.
It was. It wasn't enough. They were both phoning me and saying this is fairly urgent. What I had to do in the end, or what worked for me, and I just sort of thought, this might be helpful for other parents, is it's really, really important that the child feels accepted in themselves. Of course, I did what I could, you know, whenever I could prevent anything happening, I did. But that building of a closer relationship, we had a close relationship, but even closer, building it closer and really just accepting her exactly as she was, and of course prayer, she eventually came to the point where she would go and get some professional help who got her through it, and you know she's on the other side of it now.
But Shammy, I don't know, you're sharing,
hoping that perhaps that might be helpful.
It is so helpful. But let's get a comment or two from Michelle for Shammy and on the suggestions that Shammy has.
Oh, Shammy, do you know what, the listeners will get a lot from that. Sexual abuse, bullying are highly linked to self-harm, and they do impact young people's mental health. And what your little girl was doing is processing trauma. And that is a process just like you described. Sometimes we want to come in and blame something or fix something straight away, and we've got to realise that this is a process for our kids to walk through. And for her, it sounds like it was a process of trusting you and trusting different professionals in her life so she could get to a point where she did find a relationship where she felt safe enough to really process things and to walk through this. You know that snooping thing came up, Shammy, that you mentioned? I've got a blog, Is Snooping Okay? And I actually posted it last week. It's on my website if anyone wants to read it. But sometimes when these extreme situations are happening, just like Shammy just, you know, described, I've said to mums, you know, like, you have to say to your daughter, there is nothing I wouldn't do to protect you. But I also say to them, look, is snooping really going to give you what you need right now? Or do you need to just really trust your guts? Because oftentimes what we find when we're looking through a kid's journal or through their phone is potentially exactly what we thought
was happening or exactly what we thought we needed to do as a parent. And it doesn't really give us more information that's going to help the situation. It often inflames it. I'm not sure what happened with your situation with that, whether that helped or didn't, whether your daughter found out or didn't. But I want to emphasise in there that it's actually trusting relationships that our kids are looking for. And whereas snooping gives us validation, sometimes it breaks trust with our kids as well.
Okay. Thank you so much to Shammy for calling in and sharing your thoughts there. And this idea of snooping, the idea of checking your children's journals. Just let me ask this little further question to this, Michelle. Are our teenagers sometimes wanting us and leaving clues so that somehow or other they will be found out and that some help will come by that means? The idea of snooping. Some kids will know their parents better than others, and some kids will know that their parents snoop, and so we might just leave a note, just leaving a trail of what's happening.
And it's normally confirming and affirming what parents already know. And that's probably my point. Parents are hunting for validation to know that their kids are either self-harming or not doing very well. And in the process of that, for a lot of kids, that can kind of break trust and be a little bit of a thing to build again. But, you know, there's nothing we won't do to protect our kids. And in Shami's situation, when things were really at a point where there were safety issues involved, I can totally understand that as well.
So snooping might confirm your fears, but it will in fact breach trust, because this idea of privacy and, you know, what were you doing reading my diary, these sorts of things can actually breach the trust and actually make things worse. So you've got to balance that. We're taking calls.
Know without knowing. I think that's probably what I say a lot, is know without having to know all the facts. Just trust your instincts on it.
We're taking calls. 1-800-316-316. Let's hear from Robin in Mount Morgan. Hi, Robin.
Yes, hi. I've spoken very often about my own journey. I mean, I went through all of that, suicide and stuff like that. But as a psych nurse, I learned quite a lot. I used to question my patients a lot, because my understanding is that very often there's the natural becomes a spiritual problem. And so that is where, you know, there has to be some spiritual intervention, because, I mean, I have many cases that I could tell you, but so there's an entry point. The enemy looks for an entry point, which can be any of those things, those natural things like being raped or some bad experience or even an accident or something like that. So I always ask my patients those questions. But then a lot of it, well, I'll just give you one example. There was an identical twin. Now, she was this was a good example, because you could see her sister. Her sister was 100% fine, completely healthy. They had a very loving family. The family would come in, and they were very loving and very intelligent family. Both girls were at uni. And I asked all these questions to rule out the natural causes. And she finally told me, well, my sister and I have different interests. And this is where we came down to. She told me that she was into acting, and she was doing Macbeth. So she found a witchcraft book in some second-hand shop or something. So she studied that for her acting part. And I know that that's where her problem is. She was really suicidal, absolutely compulsive suicidal. And yet in every other way, mentally, she seemed normal. But I said to her, if I were you, I would burn those books. And she wouldn't do that, because she was so caught up in them. And there was another example I can give. When I was in a young people's home, which is for wayward girls, so it's really like a prison, they're locked up. We had upstairs and downstairs, and yet, you know, somebody mentioned before that they get ideas from their mates. I'm not sure about that, because I think it's something spiritual, because very often we would have a run of attempted suicides. And very often they weren't connected. There would be girls upstairs and girls downstairs that don't intermix. And I just sort of felt there's some sort of spiritual influence.
Robin, you're raising some really powerful points here that often don't get raised when you're having a secularized conversation about the causes of these things. And I'll get Michelle's thoughts, because sometimes when we talk about these things, you get a psychological approach. But as Christians, we recognize there's another dimension, a spiritual dimension too. I wonder whether you've got some thoughts, Michelle, for the things that Robin is sharing.
I think, Robin, like for all of us, no matter what degree it is, there is always a war for our souls and our spiritual identity. And young people are making lots of choices every single day that is going to either lead them to a future of hope and life and a relationship with God, or I tell you what, evil is right at the door for their lives. And whether they get exposed to that by looking at, you know, some books on death or searching for Instagram profiles on self-harm, that whatever they see influences how they think and how they feel and how they behave. And that's the biblical cycle of things. So what our kids see is incredibly important. There's a story of a family in the book, and one of their daughter actually really got into horror kind of movies and reading things about death at quite a young age, and that had a really big impact on her when she hit the tween years. The very real thing.
Okay, thank you so much to Robin in Mount Morgan. Let's talk a little more about these sorts of triggers, because when we're talking about self-harm, we've heard people who've mentioned trauma and sexual abuse. These sorts of things. You're raising even now this idea of what children might be exposed to online, images on social media, the sorts of things that we allow our children to easily access, and that may be a mistake for us as parents. How tightly do you need to be controlling, particularly for young children, the sorts of things they're exposed to here, Michelle, because those sorts of things may be contributing to the way that they'll act out in behaviours later on?
And of course they're contributing. I mean, everything we see, especially online, because the visual stimuli and the graphics is just so captivating. Young people can be spending a lot of time online and in that time not be digesting some really healthy concepts. So there's an internal storm and there's an external storm. You know, when our kids' internal storm is strong and they're rocking and they're not stable, I think we have to be more and more careful of what they're exposed to externally. Now, that's very idealistic when you've got a 15-year-old with their own phone and can pay for their own, you know, data and all the rest of it. But when they're younger, we have to be so vigilant around this and make sure we're very aware of what they're looking at online and what they're doing online. More for kids being online, it just has to be healthy use of it.
A very powerful point to make. Look, there are so many big dimensions and we're running out of time, but let me ask you about this, because, in fact, I think if we go through all of those who've called in and the sorts of discussions we've been having this hour, most of these have been focused on young girls. But I wanted to ask you, Michelle, what about boys in this situation? Because boys are into self-harm as well. Girls tend to get the spotlight because of some issues, perhaps particularly that are unique for girls. But what about boys and girls? Are there differences in the way they self-harm?
It's an interesting one. There's a research paper called the Self-Harm and Suicide in Adolescence paper. It was done with boys and girls between 12 and 15 years old. And there was this suggestion that the ratio was almost as high as 5 or 6 to 1 in favour of girls self-harming. However, there's other research to suggest that boys self-harm, but self-harm in very different ways. So boys are more likely to tend toward high-risk behaviour that in other people's eyes might not be identified as self-harm. So, you know, punching a wall, we might go, oh, he's just angry, you know, or driving a car recklessly. And some of these behaviours are behaviours that they've learnt from, you know, older male role models in how to process and manage their emotions. Girls tend towards more self-injury, cutting, overdoses, that type of thing, whereas boys are much more likely to be involved in self-battery, jumping from high heights or doing something really reckless.
All right. And I do want to get some insight from you, Michelle, because time is running out. when you recognise that there's potential for self-harming your family, or where you can identify that it is happening, you've got those escalating emotions and you've got this cycle of anger or those things that are triggers that lead up to it. And as you said, you've got to pick your timing in this when you actually have some input, some say into the situation. And it may be when everything is calm that you actually have those conversations. So let's go to the sorts of conversations that a parent might have. How do you broach this? Is it something you talk about around the table? Is it something you go out on a coffee date to do? Give us some insights here.
Yeah, it's a really hard one. I can tell you there's no, like, this is what you do. Every situation is different. And sometimes the best thing you can do is lean into a child in a real soft and close way and connect with them rather than have that conversation. But look, if you found a blade with some dry blood on it in your room or, you know, a host of other things that indicate they're self-harming, you may have to have a direct conversation. And I'd like you to plan that conversation very carefully in your head. It's going to start, it's going to have a middle, and it needs to have an end. And there's some specific steps in the book about this, but I think overreactions and saying something, you know, there must be something wrong for you to do, wrong with you to do this. I think you're doing this to get attention. If you don't stop, I'll have to punish you. You know, lots of people go through bad stuff in life and don't end up cutting. You'll end up in hospital or worse, and we put a lot more emotion on that situation. We're going to just inflame things. So we need to reassure them that we're there for them. One of the key questions I get parents to ask is, how can I best support you? Because I think what happens is we make a whole lot of assumptions based on what we think kids need without asking that question, how can I best support you? Make sure at the end of the conversation you always leave the door open. And that door open needs to say, hey, this is not the last conversation we're going to have about this. And it's definitely something they will go away and process quite deeply, every word that you've said, and they might need some clarification and some support going forward to help make sense of how you're feeling as well.
And I imagine that all of our children, our teenagers, are looking at who we are and what we do, and if our own lifestyle is directed almost towards the idea of triggering self-harm attitudes and behaviours, we perhaps need to be promoting self-care for our own selves and modelling that for our children and our teenagers as well. It's been a wonderful conversation, Michelle, and I do want to point people to get a hold of your new book. I know that there'll be some who'll be clamouring for it. It's called Self-Harm, Why Teens Do It, and What Parents Can Do to Help. And I'll point people to your website, michellemitchell.org, and no doubt people can access a copy of your book on that website, Michelle. We didn't get much chance to talk too much about your charity called Youth Excel that you founded, but just quickly on Youth Excel, how do people get in touch with Youth Excel?
Youth Excel actually closed at the end of last year, Neil, and it did so because I have such a lot of work in my writing and speaking now. So I have a variety of agencies that I refer families to in our region, and that's the way I service it now. Some of my staff are carrying on some great work in psychology, and there's some great professionals out there that are helping. So that's where Youth Excel is actually at.
And do you have some of those referral organisations on your website?
Yes, and they can also just direct message me if they want a copy of just the local agencies that I refer to.
Okay, so michellemitchell.org is Michelle's website. I also just mention again, Christian Counsellors Association of Australia, they're all around the nation, ccaa.net.au. Also, Lifeline, if there's an emergency that you need to talk to someone, 13 11 14. And for prayer, a Vision Christian Prayer, Pray For Me, is always open, a listening ear, and someone who will pray for you in your circumstance, what's going on in your family, 1-800-772-936. Michelle Mitchell, just wonderful getting your insights today. Thank you so much for taking some time to share those with our listeners here on 2020.
My absolute pleasure, Neil. Thanks for having me.
Before you go, thanks for listening.
There's lots more great audio on demand, or you can listen to us live at visionradio.org.au.
And remember, Vision is listener supported.
Your donation,
large or small,
will help us continue connecting faith to life for hundreds of thousands of people across Australia and around the world.
Learn more or donate today at visionradio.org.au.